Welcome back, everybody, and good to have you all with us here this morning. We have in the studio with us, once again this week, Dr. Natasha Pratt-Harris, here at Morgan State University, Associate Professor and Criminal Justice Program Coordinator in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Morgan State University, a member of the Disproportionate Minority Contact Committee for Baltimore City. Dr. Jared Ball is Associate Professor at the School of Global Journalism and Communication here at Morgan State, co-editor of Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, and author of I Mix What I Like, a mixtape manifesto. He can be found online at imixwhatilike.org. And good to have you both with us.
Thanks again. Thanks. Although, just a quick correction, yeah, lie of reinvention, just the quick correction.
What did I say?
A Life.
Which
was
a lie.
The original.
So, yes, yeah.
Like. Anyway, just small points. Sorry to slow us down.
One letter can make a big difference. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. I'll log on to our Facebook pages. I'll look there. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner. So let's talk about this rally, what's going on today. And Natasha, my sense is that you are one of the lead organizers of this, right?
Yes, I am.
So talk a bit about it.
Well, you know, today marks the, in addition to acknowledging the tragedy with Emmett Till, today marks the 51st anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech.
Right.
And we have so much going on in our country in 2014, so much going on in the city of Baltimore in 2014, relative to even trying to keep the dream alive or acknowledging some of the things that King foresaw during this time period not even happening. We felt it important to kind of address, the passionate discourse and response to what happened in Ferguson and, you know, kind of acknowledge what we have dealt with in the city of Baltimore relative to the high murder rate and violence in general. So we want to actually have engaged discussion, rally, lecture, addressing violence and crime in Baltimore and the community at large.
This is also the anniversary of the march in New York City in 1998. Amadou Diallo, who was tortured and killed by the police in New York, and this is the anniversary of the march to protest that of many Haitians who walked through the streets and others who walked through the streets that day. Jared?
Well, I'm just happy to support the event, and I'm very glad that Dr. Pratt-Harris put it together and that it's taking place here at Morgan State. I mean, already with this being the first week of classes, we've already seen a majority, I would argue, of students wanting this to be part of the conversation in our classes already. People having questions, ideas, venting, and just wanting to learn more about what happened and the context in which this is happening. So I think in even in addition to the historical points you've all have already raised, I mean, it's always good, to remember that we're still in August, in Black August, the political tradition emanating out of the George Jackson-led prison movement that looks to commemorate all of the particular highlight particular radical moments in the Black liberation struggle over time, and use this month in its full appreciation. Black August, and, you know, incorporates not only, you know, these kinds of teach-ins and rallies and political education, but fasting and commemoration of that struggle that has advanced us to a certain point, and I think could advance us much farther if we were to reconnect to it. But so I'm just glad to be a participant here and to help. I think, shape how these conversations around Michael Brown and Ferguson and police violence take place.
You know? So what happens today? What time and where and what happens?
Okay. We're going to be at the Jenkins Amphitheater and the Jenkins Lecture Hall, Room 104, at 11 o'clock a.m. until 1 o'clock p.m. This is the first university hour for the 2014-15 academic year. And again, you know, this is just an important time for us. In addition to today, we're actually organizing some panel and lectures that will happen throughout the course of the semester and academic year to address what I acknowledge as disproportionate victimization of Black males in particular.
Mm-hmm. So talk a bit about that. I mean, this is a huge piece of your work.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a bit about that.
Yes. It actually kind of characterizes my work. I often look at the disproportionate experience of Black males in particular in the criminal justice system. Their disproportionate representation. Oftentimes, the discussion is on this idea that the majority of persons who are incarcerated are Black male, but in fact, it's not the majority. It's just that they represent a disproportionate amount of those who are incarcerated. I also reference that what we have is a disproportionate representation of Black male youth who have been wrongfully convicted. So that's another issue that I address heavily, empirically speaking. But particularly, I have particular interest in looking at what we have all experienced, whether it's watching what happens on the news or, you know, personal experiences and involved in research and what we talk about in the classroom, the disproportionate victimization of Black males. And that runs the gamut. We're looking at Black-on-Black crime. We're looking at crime in inner cities. We're looking at police brutality, police mistreatment, the reality that you have what's called unjustified homicide, something that's not heavily acknowledged in so much as the data. There's little to no data out there to confirm the number of unjustified homicides that have happened in and throughout the country. We have examples of it. We know it exists. If it's not widely publicized, Black males often, you know, describe at least having the experience of being mistreated while being accosted by law enforcement, you know, nationally speaking.
So one of the things that happens on this program every time we have this discussion and the people call in at 410-319-8888 is that the conversation about victimization always crosses the line between being victimized by the system, by authorities. That happens every day on a formal, informal basis. Doesn't always end up in murder or necessarily beatings, but humiliations that happen every day on the streets of Baltimore and every other city in this country, to the internal warfare that goes on inside the poorest communities in our country. That's a kind of a, some people describe it as a self-loathing inner genocide that goes on in the streets. I mean, how do we talk about both of things in a kind of very real and political way?
Well, for me, they both emanate from the same thing. I mean, I think that there's a state-sponsored attempt to impoverish and confuse and destabilize communities, particularly Black communities in this country. And then, of course, that is backed up by the very official state-sanctioned killing of all these Black, mostly men, by the police and related police agencies. You know, and I would add to your point about the numbers. I mean, the Malcolm X grassroots movement did attempt to put verifiable numbers to the amounts of these killings that take place. And in their Operation Ghetto Storm report, or the Every 28 Hours report, they determined that by the numbers of police killings of Black men and women, just Black men and women in this country, that these killings take place every 28 hours. And even since Michael Brown, we've seen at least two more that I can think of off the top of my head, incidents where the police are killing unarmed Black people. Or putting, as we heard reported this morning, threatening to do that by putting the barrel of their gun in someone's mouth, which is inexplicably part of some arrest or detainment process. So for me, at least, again, you know, I think that there is this organized, planned sort of inequality that can be predictably associated with the kinds of behaviors we see in the street on a daily basis. And then we've also seen attempts in popular media to say that, to characterize these communities as saying, well, we'll only protest when the police kill us. And we don't protest or rally when our own community members kill each other, which is, of course, false. But there's been an attempt to portray these uprisings and rebellious activities as only occurring in response to police violence. But at the same time, I don't want to have there be there's also an attempt to discredit or discount the violence of the police based on existing violence elsewhere. And I think that they cannot be. One cannot be used to cancel out the other or to justify the other. And one is more, I think, overtly state sanctioned than the other. There is a state sanction, and even in the militarization of the police and all this, and the historical establishment of the SWAT teams, you know, all to blunt popular rebellion and Black liberation struggles. I mean, there's an overt state component to this, state sponsored component to this, that I think needs its own particular response.
I'm curious, both of you mentioned and said that, alluding to the fact that students really want to have conversations about this. I'm curious about the conversations that have taken place for both of you with students and others in this campus.
I've definitely had intense conversations with students. Class just started this week. I had my first graduate class last evening. It's a statistics class, and students are talking about the experience, one in particular, of actually growing up in St. Louis, you know, not far from Ferguson at all, and what the reality of life is there, knowing that the issues that we saw in the 1960s and prior relative to the disparate treatment of persons of color are still occurring in 2014. And what happened in Ferguson, heart-wrenching, but something that kind of symbolizes the very real disparity that occurs in towns like Ferguson and towns like Ferguson throughout the country. So students are concerned. They're upset. They want answers. They're trying to figure out how, in fact, that they can possibly impart change as it relates to these issues. One of the things that we'll be talking about today is some of the grassroots organizations that may be able to become a part of and be active with, or they can, in fact, share who they're active with to kind of address and or combat some of these very inequities. And on Monday during the show, I mentioned, for example, the 300 Men March in Baltimore and the possibility of students on our campus engaging with that grassroots organization that addresses violence in Baltimore City in particular. So,
Jared.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to what Professor Pratt Harris is saying here, that, you know, a lot of students seems to just want to talk about it in general. I think that for some of them, there's been an inadequate amount of space and time to express their feelings about what they've been seeing and hearing about. We've also had a couple of conversations, you know, brief conversations in class about how little some know about what's going on and has been going on. And part of conversations in our class around, you know, media communication and what people are focused on or encouraged to focus on, which I was honestly a little surprised about, given how much attention has been given to this and who's been involved, including, you know, rappers like, you know, J. Cole and stuff like that, been involving themselves to some extent. David Banner was just out there, Jasiri X and others, Talib Kweli and Rosa Clemente were all out there shedding some more light, you know, that might reach certain students. But, you know, so that's been, you know, a part of it too. But I think also, and one other piece that I thought that is a little startling, and this has been something I've noticed over the years I've been teaching, is that there's even a tendency for students from certain communities to have accepted this as normal. You know,
right.
that they're so unmoved because they see how often this happens. And one of the things that we struggle to say is, like, we know this happens all the time, but mm-hmm. you can't accept this as acceptable or normal or part of what should be the normal pattern of, you know, growing up in Baltimore or anywhere else. So that's something that another reason why I was very happy to see that this event was being put together and to participate in it.
This is something we haven't done on the program yet, but I've been thinking a lot about this, and I'm just beginning to think about how to articulate it and to think it through. But ever since something has happened in America, it seems to me, in the last 6 years, since Barack Obama became president of the United States of America, there's been the tension around race in America in some ways has been heightened since he's become president of the United States. I think at the same time, a certain consciousness has also risen among larger parts of the population about race in America. And I think it's coming to a glaring point. I think Ferguson, in some strange way to me, is connected to that moment when people first saw a black family walk into the White House. And this something happened in Ferguson that is connected to that in terms of saying the rage around the racist and systemic racism, institutionalized racism, is coming to a head in ways that have never happened before in America. You know, the fight against segregation, which we'll be talking about in the next half an hour and how that relates today with Emmett Till and Fannie Lou Hamer in the South. There's a different struggle in the 21st century. You know, how Du Bois talked about the 21st century, 20th century will be the struggle around mm-hmm. race. Mm-hmm. But 21st century is going to be the same struggle, but I think it's going to be defined very differently. I haven't articulated it as well as I want to, because I'm just beginning to kind of try to think what that means through and how you put that discussion on the airwaves.
Well, I think what's happened is we're in some pockets, we are actually in shock. You know, there is a huge discrepancy between having a African-American family, a black family in the White House, and having the same realities in our neighborhoods, or when we look at what's happened, you know, so much as police community relations and, you know, the Trayvon Martins of the world, you know, it doesn't make sense that 2014 America looks like that. but it does. And I think, you know, where we are is that, you know, we are actually led to kind of address these issues or acknowledging that we should address these issues, but we thought we took care of that, you know, during the civil rights era, and those things shouldn't come up. Now, from a black person's perspective, I would say it's brewing in so much as it's always been there.
Oh, yes, right.
But
right,
now
right.
There's a confirmation because of these, you know, public displays of what's real in so much as, you know, the mistreatment of persons of color. So it definitely hasn't gone away. One of my concerns is this whole potential for persons being desensitized. But that's a part of the human condition. You know, we keep seeing this over and over again. We didn't get a break and, you know, not to offer sensitivity to what we're experiencing today. But, you know, we're not far removed from the Trayvon Martin experience. And then having this occur, you know, on the heels of that, you know, persons aren't ready to react possibly. But again, it's a part of the human experience to become desensitized. You know, think about Vietnam
right.
and how people receive the realities of the tragedies of war during that time. So, you know.
And I also think that in some ways what's happening, Jared, is that America, at least portions of America, are now beginning to wrestle with, I really do think for the first time in many ways, I'm talking about outside the black community, how much race defines this country mm-hmm. and has from its inception, from the inception of slavery, fueling the rise of Western capitalism and all the rest. I think people are just beginning. This is a new discussion for most of America.
Yeah, no, I mean, I hear you. We were arguing, some of us at least were arguing from the beginning that, you know, this we can't, the process that produced President Obama has not changed, so we shouldn't expect change to come from that same process. Mm-hmm. And this is what I hope that folks will, this moment will inspire people and encourage people to move past that contradiction of there being a black president and the same kind of violence happening day after day after day after day. And then use that to realize we need radically different forms of use of the vote, if that's going to be the solution, radically different forms of organization. And response. And I was actually glad, to the extent that it happened, to see Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton booed when they went to Ferguson. Because I'm hopeful that out of that will come this recognition that is not the leadership that I think we should be following. That is not the leadership that's going to provide the solutions that we seek, and that we need something different, something new. And so whether it was a visceral or even an unconscious response, or more organized and conscious, I'm happy to have seen something even like that, because I think it speaks to this idea that, you know, there's a recognition that for all the talk of progress and change and difference, we're still here suffering the exact same living conditions and treatment by the state. So that's what I hope will happen. And that the sameness in all of this will carry us to something new, to some kind of new movement, some sort of new form of organization.
I mean, because I'll talk in the next half an hour when Peniel Joseph and John Mussey join us about that. I mean, people fought to end segregation and thought people that meant integration, but then the question always was integrating into what,
mm-hmm.
you know, and what, how you define that. And maybe part of the discussion in the 21st century is a building a new kind of society that people want to integrate with. Do you know what I'm saying? Because what we have now is not what.
By the way, and somewhat related, I hope that at some point, and I think you were one of the few spaces where this could occur, fortunately or unfortunately, that you will host a debate with Peniel Joseph about his book on Stokely Carmichael, which I think is in many ways very disturbing in its analysis about Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, and the world in which we live now, and I think has everything to do with what we're going to do in response to these things like in Ferguson.
Oh, well, let's do that.
Yeah, I think that would, yeah, you should check that thing out, man.
Well, I've read the book.
Okay, oh, you've read the book.
So I interviewed him for the book.
Oh, you did do that?
Oh, yeah, wow.
You should have a debate on that.
We'll talk about
that. I'll call it out on the air and make it happen.
Because one of the things that book did for me was it opened parts of about Kwame Ture that we didn't know mm-hmm. in a positive sense as well. Mm-hmm. His relationship with Martin,
mm-hmm.
which is very complex and deep,
mm-hmm.
And the kind of things that he created during that period that people didn't realize he created in a positive sense.
But all the things that he said that Kwame Ture said that were right are diminished in Joseph's book. And for our purposes today, it's specifically how we organize ourselves to deal with what will again happen police violence against our community. And that's in reading Peniel's book, you see how that wing of analysis is diminished. And the book is really about sort of like, you know, Turay was an unfortunate, you know, potential once upon a time hero who went in the wrong direction. His ideas doomed him to obscurity.
I have to reread the book slowly and more thoroughly.
But in terms of today, and this is why I think again why this teaching is so important, is that people like Turay and the wing of analysis that has been marginalized, that offered up prescriptive response, preparation and response to these kinds of occurrences, I think has to be brought back into these kinds of conversations if we're going to save ourselves and move forward and make a better world in this country and elsewhere.
And we have to take a break here, but let's. A final thought, Natasha, and get people to come to this thing today.
Yes, 11 o'clock a.m. to 1 o'clock p.m. We'll be outside of Jenkins and Amphitheater to room 104, and we're just going to kind of be able to conversate and engage and talk and hopefully come up with some solutions or some ways to make change.
Always great to have the two of you in studio once. This is nice. Mm-hmm. I want to thank the doctors Natasha Pratt-Harris and Jared Ball for joining us in this first half an hour, and join everybody here at 11 o'clock. You can take your iPod and listen to us at the same time if you like.
Multitask.
But go over to the rally and conversation. It's important to have. Thank you both.
Thank you
for having us.
We're going to take a very brief break, and we are breaking out with Ernie Fields, Christopher Columbus, 1904, the swing jazz musician. Ernie Fields, born in Texas on this day and raised in Oklahoma. He'd be known as the band leader for the Tulsa-based Royal Entertainers. We'll be right back. Don't go away.